You are listening to Right On Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM, and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Liz Olds. Tonight on Right On Radio, I'll be talking with Jennifer Dupuis to discuss her debut novel, The Little French Bridal Shop, a book with some small-town secrets and a touch of romance. The Little French Bridal Shop is described by Louise Miller as a story about discovering your authentic self when things get hard and the joys you can find when you live from your heart.
And I'm Josh Weber. In the last part of the hour, I'll be talking with Frances de Vericourt, one of the co-authors of the new book, Framers, Human Advantage in an Age of Technology and Turmoil. To frame is to make a mental model that enables us to see patterns, predict how things will unfold, and make sense of new situations. Framers shows us how framing is not just a way to improve how we make decisions, but why it will be a matter of survival for humanity in a time of societal upheaval. All this and more, so stay tuned to Right On Radio.
Jennifer, are you there?
I'm here, Liz.
Great. Welcome to Right On Radio. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thanks so much for having me.
Why don't we start with a little description of the book and then the reading that you have planned for us?
That sounds great. So the book is set in motion when my protagonist, Larissa Pearl, returns to her small seaside hometown upon the death of her great aunt, Ursula. And she's, you know, she's in a bit of a funk. She's just lost her job. She's recently broken up with her boyfriend, and she's struggling with her mother's failing health. On a whim, she wanders into the local bridal shop and buys a dress, even though she has no groom. Soon word spreads all over town that she's getting married. And rather than dispel the rumor, she perpetuates it. Small town chaos ensues. And so I'll start off here. I have a little bit, just as she's returned to the house that she's inherited. So I'll start with that. She left the photos behind and headed down the stairs to the dining room. She smiled, as she always did, at the wallpaper, a heavy navy blue imprinted with a repeating pattern of tan and white pheasants glancing over their shoulders, apprehensive. The pheasants looked so silly, startled out of their forward momentum, that she couldn't help but laugh. But her smile shrunk when she turned the corner and spotted a large strip of the paper peeling away from the wall above the fireplace, dangling like the tongue on a cartoon dog. Crap, she whispered to herself. If her mother had been more with it was the sort of project they might have tackled together. A mother-daughter do-it-yourself special, fixing up the house and taking occupancy. But no, it was too big to manage. Best to just make the repairs and sell the place. So, after balancing on a chair and trying to no avail to press the paper back into place, she gathered her things, headed outside, and tramped back down the hill towards Duffy's Hardware, where she hoped to find some wallpaper glue. She'd almost made it there when, partway through Main Street, her gaze alighted once again on the mannequin in the window of the bridal shop. She stopped and peered in. The model's hand, she noticed now, had been painted with a pale pink French manicure, and she had a faux diamond adorning her delicately raised ring finger. Larissa snickered, yet something took hold of her, a mischievous and imposterous side of herself that had recently been surfacing to her surprise and delight. Wouldn't it be fun, just for a laugh, she thought, to take a peek at those dresses, to pretend for a moment that she was that mannequin, or even her own mother, pre-illness, skipping down the steps of the church. How did one feel, she wondered, wearing such a dress? She suspected she'd feel ridiculous, pompous and overplumed like a peacock. But no one would have to know she wasn't serious. Would she dare? She sucked in her breath and smiled to herself. Yes, she would. And so this was how Larissa found herself, with her hand on the doorknob, deciding to her own amusement that perhaps she would go in and try on some dresses just for the heck of it. Why not? What else did she have to do? And so she stepped in, a little bell tinkling as she pushed open the door, and before she knew it, she stood directly in front of Mrs. Muldoon, her eighth-grade English teacher, who, with clipboard and pen in hand, seemed to be taking inventory. Larissa froze, acutely aware that now was the time for escape. But then Mrs. Muldoon took down her glasses, letting them drop on a chain against her bosom. Looking a little perturbed, or maybe just befuddled, she lifted her gaze to her customer. I'm sorry, stammered Larissa. You weren't expecting me. I guess I'm supposed to have an appointment for this kind of thing. So it was dim in her mind. Larissa must have heard at some point that Mrs. Muldoon had retired from teaching to open up a bridal shop. And so she wasn't quite as surprised as she might have been when Mrs. Muldoon's eyes lit up in recognition and she jettisoned the clipboard to smother Larissa in an all-encompassing hug. "Not for a local like Larissa Pearl," she crooned. "Honey, how are you? I heard you might be back, but my word, look at you. Larissa Pearl on my front stoop. Don't just stand there. Come in." Larissa took a step forward so that she stood in the center of the room. The shop was small and square with a display case toward the back and dresses hanging all around the perimeter, some long and sleek, others puffed and gauzy, most of them some tone of creamy off-white. One corner featured a small collection of Mother of the Bride and Bridesmaid dresses, maroons, salmons, teals, while the other displayed an assortment of veils, lacy, piped, pattern. "Well, I'm not really back." Larissa struggled to release herself from Mrs. Muldoon's hug. "Timmy O'Leary saw you coming off the train this afternoon. He and I both get coffee after lunch at Antonio's. And somehow, don't ask me how, I knew you'd be by. I had a full-on premonition." Mrs. Muldoon stepped back and stood grinning at Larissa, hands on her hips. "I just knew you'd come visit me at the shop." Larissa nodded, trying to look noncommittal, not sure whether to blow her cover so soon. "The gowns, are they actually French?" she asked, glancing around. Mrs. Muldoon waved her hand in the air as if swatting a fly. "Oh, no, no, that's just a gimmick to get people in the door." They stood there for a moment, facing each other, while Larissa took it all in, her gaze starting at one corner of the shop and working around to the other. "So many," she said, not knowing what else to say. Mrs. Muldoon flattened her palms in front of her and pumped them up and down as though halting a moving vehicle. "Now, don't panic. It can be overwhelming, but don't worry. I can absolutely find something perfect for your special day. I have a knack for finding the right dress." "No, no," Larissa started again, but Mrs. Muldoon cut her off. "Larissa Pearl is getting married," she chanted, hopping in place on her medium-heeled pumps. "Larissa Pearl is getting married." So, I'll stop there. But okay. You can see how this ruse gets started.
Yes, and also thus begins the mild untruths that Larissa shares with people during the course of the book. And why don't we start there? There's a lot of threads in the book. They mostly revolve around Larissa and her relationships with different people. And she does kind of get herself in some trouble by trying to make everything fit or make it all right. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. No spoilers, of course.
Of course, yeah, of course. So, you know, Larissa from the beginning, I recognized that she sort of wasn't quite herself. She's, you know, one part of the story, but after, you know, she sort of noticed this leak in the wallpaper, she takes a crowbar to the wallpaper in an effort to kind of find the source of the leak. And, right, she buys this dress so she has no groom and she perpetuates these lies. And she's really grappling with her mother's failing health. And I realized that she's not quite herself. And this was a state that I recognized, really, because it was something I deeply felt when I was grappling with my own mother's illness and then subsequent death from breast cancer. And even though Larissa's mother is struggling from dementia, not cancer, as I began to delve into the writing of the story, Larissa's deceptions really became a vehicle to explore the feelings of loss of identity, disorientation, and confusion that consume a child, even an adult child who becomes a caretaker of an ailing parent. And that's really where I found I wanted to go with the story.
Yes. One of the characters that has passed, but is very, very... a big part of the book is Ursula, and another big part of the book is Elmhurst, which is a character in itself, the mansion. You want to talk about Ursula and the mansion? The mansion's quite, I get a beautiful view of it in my mind, and then I see Larissa going at that wall, and I think the same thing. She's a little upset. So anyway, talk about Ursula and Elmhurst.
Yeah, so Larissa has a great aunt Ursula who's passed. She's no longer present, as you say, in the present action of the book. She's no longer alive, rather, in the present action of the book. But she really is a character in the book that's still omnipresent. And Larissa had a very close relationship with her. She never married, so she's a bit of a foil in a way to this wedding plot that's going on. And we learn more about that as the book unfolds. But she's sort of this grand old character who, you know, eats French lentils and dill, salmon and dill. And she teaches Larissa and the caretaker of the house named Jack, you know, kind of about the finer things of life. So she's really, in flashbacks and sort of in memory, she's really still very much alive in the book. And I was blessed with some very charismatic older relatives, female relatives in my life, and I really drew on many of them for that character of Aunt Ursula. She's a fun character. And then, yes, Elmhurst is the house that Larissa has inherited from her great aunt, and it is very much a character in the book. Larissa's known it her entire life, and Jack, the male character, has been the caretaker of it since he was 17. He's now 40-ish in the book. And the two of them embark on some renovations of the house together, and they've known each other for some time, but they've never quite, you know, kind of come into each other's orbit in quite this way until now. So the house is a vehicle sort of in the renovations for them to get to know each other.
And there's also a relationship, as you said, between Jack and Elmhurst. That's the beginning of Jack's part in the story, and he loves Elmhurst, and he talk more about that relationship. It's a real human relationship.
Oh yeah, I mean Elmhurst is sort of like you know, his wife sort of refers to it as his mistress in a way, you know, because he's always there. He's worked there since he was 17. He's kind of a do-it-yourselfer. He runs a contracting business, but he also is this caretaker. And so he's taught himself through the years since he was 17 how to renovate this house and care for it. So he in some ways, actually really at the beginning, is more invested in the house than Larissa, because he's felt her bones. You know, he's fixed the windows, and he's reshingled the roof on the carriage house, and he's redone the electrical system, and he really knows the house inside and out.
Mm-hmm. And then he and Larissa have to start putting the house back together again after she tears the wall down, and they decide to do a full renovation, right?
That's right, yeah.
You do a really good job of presenting a small town community and all the different things that happen in a small town. And I'm wondering, have you lived in a small town, or how did you know all the truths of a small town?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my grandmother grew up, I grew up north of Boston, and my grandmother lived for many years nearby in the seaside town of Beverly Farms, which is next to Manchester by the Sea. People may know that name from the movie. And they're both these really small, charming seaside towns. There's sort of, for both of each of them, one main street that runs through the center of town. So I really grew on both of these towns. The settings for both of them are just deeply ingrained in my psyche. And I drew on them as I created this fictional town of Kent's Crossing. So I did have a very strong feeling for this town and what it was like. Mm-hmm.
Now, in the acknowledgments, let's talk a little bit about you. It implies, and I don't know if I'm right about this, but it implies that you're a part of triplets. Is that true?
I am, actually. And there is a set of fraternal triplets in the book. Quick sort of tangent here. My parents were expecting twins. I'm in my late 40s, so ultrasound at the time was it existed, but it was primitive. And so literally until my sister was born, they thought they were having twins. So I was born first, and my brother was born second. Yeah, and my father said, oh, what more could we want? One of each, a boy and a girl, that's great. And the doctor said, well, wait a minute.
One more baby. Here comes another one.
Yeah. So, and it's something, you know, I never really thought I would write about. But then as I was writing these pages, I realized that part of Larissa's struggle is one of identity. And also, the mother's struggle is one of identity. She's dealing with dementia. And I knew that Jack, the male character, had some kids, and I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to make them triplets, fraternal triplets? So again, not identical, but just to amplify this idea of identity, because triplets, like most siblings, but you know, perhaps even more so, triplets are very interconnected, you know, can kind of finish each other's sentences. And even though they're not identical, their relationship is intense, you know.
Another thing you do a good job of, I grew up, and part of the time I lived on an island in Maryland, and I had close ties to the water. And you do a very good job of Jack's relationship with the water. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so again, I grew up on the water. I grew up on the North Shore of Boston. My father was an avid sailor. He had a small sailboat, you know, very much like the boat that Jack has in the book. And I, even though I'm not as much of a sailor as my father, you know, if I had a rig boat, I could get my way around. I also grew up going to Southeast Maine, and so the water and the boating world is really central to my life. And again, not something I had written about before, but one I really loved writing about, actually. Go ahead.
Well, when you and your brother and sister, did you go out on the water the way the triplets in the book do? We definitely did.
And the boat, in the book is named Hat Trick. And my father's boat was named Hat Trick. And the joke is, you know, a hat trick.
Three
in hockey is three goals
right.
in a row. So you think about that in terms of triplets. That was sort of an analogy for the triplets.
First novels are often a bit autobiographical, and it sounds like yours is a bit autobiographical. You want to talk about how you worked your own stories into this story and what it all means to you?
Yeah, you know, so as I mentioned earlier, my mother was diagnosed with breast cancer. I was much younger than Larissa is in this book. Larissa is turning 40.
Okay.
And I was 22 when my mother was diagnosed. My parents were divorced. I ended up being one of her main caretakers because I just graduated from college. She was living alone. And I found at the time I really had this sort of like altruistic attitude of like, I can handle this, you know, I am going to hold it together and just keep my cool and get through this, kind of head down, get through it. And so as I was writing the part of Larissa and I knew that she was really struggling with her mother's illness, I related to that. But there were some differences in that, you know, Larissa sort of takes it a different way. I took it sort of, I'm just going to kind of face this head on and not have the emotions. Whereas Larissa doesn't want to face it at all and wants to sort of be in denial that it's happening. And part of her denial is just engaging in more and more and more lies related to this wedding that she's not, you know, actually having. So that was one of the ways in which I really brought myself into the book. I've also always had a fascination with old houses.
Mm-hmm.
When my husband and I were first dating, I realized he had a fascination with old houses as well. And we would often take walks down a street nearby Elmhurst Road, where we admired a historic house there. And several years later, we were married, and I had stepkids and also a young child. And this house came on the market, and we were like, oh, my God, it's meant to be. And we made a bid on the house, but we didn't get it, unfortunately.
Uh-huh.
We did later get our own historic house. I know, but it seemed like, and by that time, I had started this novel, and I began to, you know, I had this idea of this house on a hill, and I named the house Elmhurst in tribute to this house on Elmhurst Road. So there were some fun bits from my real life that made it into the book, for sure.
Have you ever driven a Rolls Royce? I'm just curious.
Oh, my gosh, no. That would be amazing. I'd love that. I have not. I can drive stick shift, but I have not driven a Rolls.
let's see. Where am I at here? Let's move on to you as a writer for a little while. Talk about the Grub Street writing community.
Yeah, so Grub Street is an amazing writing community in Boston. They are fantastic. I've been a member since, I want to say, 2003.
Wow.
And they're a wonderful, supportive writing community. They offer writing classes for Boston and the greater Boston area, although now their reach is even beyond because they're online. They're on Zoom. And you could take a 6 to 10 week class, or you could take a weekend seminar that might last 1 to 2 days. And they also hold an annual conference called the Muse in the Marketplace, where writers and agents and editors and authors get together to kind of talk and learn about the industry. And it's an amazing conference, and it's grown tremendously. So it started out, back in the early years, they probably have 200 visitors, and now they have, I think, 700 or 800 plus.
Wow.
And in addition, I have a wonderful writing group. We call ourselves the Salt and Radish Writers. And I met all of them through the Grub Street community.
How do you feel that writing communities and writers groups help a writer, and also how did your writing group help with this book?
Yeah, so writing is quite a solitary task, mm-hmm. and it's on the one hand, I love that because I do love sort of getting into the book and sort of digging in and world building and homing in on my own. On the other hand, there are days where it's, the blank page is quite a challenge. You kind of don't know where the story is going to go next. You're banging your head against the wall. You don't kind of feel motivated. And so a writing group, having somebody to kind of take you out of that void and that vacuum and to offer insight and advice is really invaluable. And with this book, it's interesting. This book really sort of meshed with me quite well from the beginning. It's not the first novel I've written, but it's the first one I've gotten published.
Mm-hmm.
But even so, you end up, kind of admiring yourself so deeply in it that you don't have perspective. So my writing group, we try to meet every 2 weeks, and we usually hit that mark. Sometimes it's 3 to 4 weeks, but it's usually right around 2 weeks. And even during the pandemic, we've been meeting over Zoom. Before the pandemic, we would meet and have drinks and a meal, and then we'd critique each other's work, and just having an extra set of eyes and extra input, and sometimes they would, they might all hone in a particular section where they'll say, something's not working, mm-hmm. and they have different ideas on how to fix it. But if at least, two of them, and certainly if all three of them agree that this section isn't working, then it's not working and I've got to address it. And that kind of insight and input is invaluable. And also they're just great cheerleaders. They keep you going when you're feeling down, and writing with a writing life, you rejection comes hand in hand.
Yeah, you got to deal with that.
Talking you through those rejections and boosting you, propping you back up.
Yes, we're almost out of time. We've been speaking tonight with Jennifer Dupuis, author of The Little French Bridal Shop. And so my last question is, what's next? What have you got in the hopper?
Yeah, so I've got two pieces that I'm working on. One I'm really only actively working on. It's still gestating, and so I won't say much about it yet. Other than that, I think it takes place in another different seaside town, and there's another house or building. It might be sort of an old hotel that's sort of another character in the book. But the piece that I'm actively working on is quite different than The Little French Bridal Shop. It's a first-person narration told from the perspective of a 7-year-old girl. Her mother is pregnant, and the entire family is eagerly awaiting the birth of this new baby girl. But the story is really set in motion when a strange man arrives at the end of the driveway and claims that baby could be his.
Oh, okay. That sounds interesting.
Uh-oh.
Sounds like fun. Another book with some secrets involved in it.
Yes, exactly.
Jennifer, it's been wonderful talking to you. The book is The Little French Bridal Shop by Jennifer Dupuis. Who is the publisher? The book is across the room. So.
Yes, that's fine. It's St. Martin's.
St. Martin's Press. All right. Mm-hmm. So thank you very much for your wonderful interview. I hope you have good luck with the book and all that. Have a good evening, and thanks very much.
Liz, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
Great. Bye-bye now.
Take care.
Today, I am talking with Frances Day Vericourt, one of the authors of the book Framers, Human Advantage in an Age of Technology in Turmoil. This work offers a reason to be optimistic. Humans have a unique ability to frame or think in mental models and can come up with solutions that meet our moment in history. Frances Day Vericourt is professor of management science and the director of the Center for Decisions, Models, and Data at the European School of Management and Technology in Berlin. Welcome to Write on Radio, Frances.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So framing is fundamental to human cognition. However, it was only until recently was there serious research and focus in on this aspect of our mind. Why did it only gain prominence recently?
Well, I guess because there were also some more basic functions to understand, like memory and other type of cognitions that we have been researching first. And it's only, you know, it started maybe at the middle of the 20th century, but it's really late 20th century, early 21st century that there has been a lot of work on our ability to represent the world and to use mental model to make decisions.
What are the key ingredients, would you say, that make up framing, decision-making that we make in our daily lives?
Well, in the book, we describe three key component. And the first one is causality. Human cannot help to think causally. We are programmed to look at effect and consequences. And so these help us make the world predictable, whether we are right or not. But we have to have a reason for how the worlds work. And then we use this causal template, if you want, to produce what we call counterfactual, that is reality that is beyond the fact, that help us project us into the future, but also imagine how the world could have been. So this is what we do when we ask what if questions. But we can ask a lot of different what if questions. We can have wild imaginations. And if we are too wild, or ideas or parallel world, if you want, won't have any connections with reality. So we need to imagine, but under constraints. And the constraint is the third element of the mental model. That's why we call it a frame. You know, the frame is really constraining what you can see, what you can imagine. And so the three components, again, is causality, counterfactual, and constraints.
Right. So there's causality, counterfactuals, and then constraints we put to order to actually have effective frames we use to build the world around us. Why is it essential for us to have restrictions on frame building?
Because it's easy to have ideas. We all have crazy ideas all the time. That's not what is difficult. What is difficult is to have good ideas, ideas that works in reality. And to help that, we need to constrain our thinking. We need to constrain our imaginations to really focus on what could work and ignore all the noises of those crazy ideas that may not work. So that's why, in fact, constraints are the key element of framing.
And I had a note in my notes here. There's a point in the book where you say how using constraints in our models is suggested, but we should also use the fewest modifications when we make those constraints. I was wondering if you could talk about why that's important.
That's right. I mean, this is a bit conceptual, but the point is when you have a good frame that is working, like we have a lot of frames of physics, for instance, but and if it's working, you don't want to deviate too much, because if you deviate too much, you start to have crazy thoughts. You start to believe that you can beam yourself in a parallel universe. Mm-hmm. And so playing with your frame and with those constraints, one of the principles is stick to what you know works. Otherwise, it's too risky.
There is, so you touched on this already, and I want to ask you more about this because I think this feature of framing is so fascinating. You talk about in the book how framing is this ability to envision other realities that make possible individual achievement and societal progress. And I like this. In my notes, I wrote this as being using imagination as a ruler for reality. And how does framing allow us to envisage what isn't there? I know you give examples about how the Apollo 11 mission, no one had ever actually navigated space before. We had to imagine the scenario, what that would look like, going, traveling over 200,000 miles to reach the moon.
No, that's correct. In fact, if you step back and if you think about the biggest innovations of humanity, they all, and most of them, happen before we had the data to show us that they were correct. And going to the moon is one example. In fact, the real direct data we had from the moon is when Armstrong put his feet on the surface. Before, it was all just representation about how things would happen. So that is something that, for instance, machine can't do. Machine requires a lot of data to make a decision, or at least predictions. And the machine is really stuck very close to the data on which it is trained. The human, in contrast, can take a couple of data points, connect the dot, and project itself well beyond that. You have that with business model. Like when you have company that disrupt an industry, everybody is, how? This is the first time you see, let's say, Airbnb disrupting a whole industry. Nobody did that before, but they could do that because they created a model. It's a business model, but it's a representation of how things would work before having all the data to prove that the idea was correct. So that's really the power in the end of our ability to model and represent the world.
You're very clear in the book how there isn't a bad frame per se. It's just a matter of applying to the right context and playing it out. However, you do have one exception, that there is a bad frame. I was wondering if you describe what that is.
So let us start with your first point. Is, for instance, when we think about Earth, we think as a sphere. So this is a way to represent the world. It's a sphere. Other people think, I mean, few people, but still some believe represent it as something flat. So that the flat Earth frame, the flat Earth frame is not a bad frame. In fact, we use it all the time, because when you go from A to B around you, you not think of Earth as something wrong. In your mind, you only see the map is two-dimensional. So it depends in which context you are. If you're flying or if you send a rocket in space, yes, you need the sphere metaphor, the sphere frame, sorry. Mm-hmm. But again, when you're driving, you're more thinking of the flat frame. So having many, many frames is important, because you need to adjust to the situation in which you are. And that's why we are really advocating to letting people develop, embrace as diverse frames as possible. But there's only one bad frame, which is precisely a frame that prevents you to have this diversity of frames. And an example we give in the book is our terrorists. I mean, there was an attack in Paris, terrorist attack, and we remember September 11. In fact, terrorists, and there are research that show that, they are stuck in one frame and one frame only. And it's a very rigid frame. So the whole world is explained by this frame. And it's very scary, because they cannot adjust and they cannot change different perspective. So that creates terrible, horrible things. So that's what I would call a bad frame. But any other frames has the right to exist. And who knows, maybe we can use these different frames in different situations.
On a related note, there is this crisis you described in the book. There's a fight between those who believe in hyper-rationalization through the likes of AI, for example, and those who believe in the authenticity of our emotions and our gut instinct. I can't deny my feeling here. This has to be true because this is what I'm feeling. Both approaches, you say, combine the two can lead to dead ends. I was wondering if you could talk about how framing is more helpful in answering civilizational challenges.
So first, the what you call the civilization challenges. We know we are going to face challenges. I can pick one, for instance, which is antibiotics. Maybe your listeners are not aware of that, but we have a huge problem with antibiotics, because bacteria are developing resistance, and there are projections that says that by 2050 there will be 10 million of people dying on Earth per year. So COVID is going to be a walk in the park compared to that. And nobody is going to be protected. I mean, if you have resistance to antibiotics, you can live in a developed country and one of the most powerful country in the world, like America, is not going to protect you. The thing is that we know that those challenges exist because we have the right frame. We know they are not there yet. Remember, we don't have the 100% data yet, but we know what's going on and we can do those counterfactual and protect ourselves in the future. So frame is what enables us to know that we have those challenges, and they are also part of the solutions. And why they are part of the solutions is because it enables us to uncover new alternatives that we didn't think of before. So a frame, what it does for you is that it expands the set of alternatives you have. Now, we don't offer concrete solutions yet for those challenges, but we are certain that if we learn collectively to be better framers, we will hopefully have the right solutions for the problems we are facing. So it's really about nurturing this ability so that we can mitigate what our frames are telling us is going to be a big danger for our species.
So I think this is a great time to ask you about how framing the issue of COVID-19 brought about different ramifications within different countries. I was wondering if you could talk about how New Zealand's response to COVID-19 differed from other countries and how they're able to resist the different impacts of the pandemic versus other countries. How did their framing of the issue, I mean, help them avert a lot of the problems the rest of the world had to deal with?
You know, it's a very interesting question, because COVID happened while we were in the middle of writing the book. I mean, we were finishing up, but and we were writing on a pandemic, which was a different one, which was in 2014 in Africa. It was the Ebola. I do not know if you remember, but there had been an outbreak of Ebola, which is a very deadly virus. There were a couple of cases, and there were two organizations on the ground, which was WHO and non-profit organizations, and they had exactly the same data, exactly the same expertise, the same goal to eradicate this outbreak, and they reached totally different conclusion. And so how come with the same data, the same expertise, the same goal, you reach totally opposite conclusions? And the reason is because they were applying different frame. And I'm not going to get into the details of those differences, but they look at the same problem with different representation, different models. And as we were talking about that, like real time, we saw on a much larger scale with COVID, several countries framing exactly the same problem, like the same virus. It was exactly the same virus. And of course, everybody wanted to achieve the same thing, but they were framing the same problem totally differently. And so what happened is that you had the UK, but to be fair, it's not only the UK. I mean, it's, many developed countries did the same thing, is that to frame that outbreak as something more like the flu, which is more dangerous, but which is something that you can contain, basically. So let us take mitigation actions. We are going to contain it and continue to live our lives normally. What New Zealand did is to frame it not as flu, but to frame it as SARS. And SARS was a very dangerous virus, as we know now, that happened in Asia. So what is very interesting with New Zealand is that New Zealand has a foot in Asia and a foot in Europe and UK especially. And so they had two frames at their disposal. They could choose to follow the UK to use the flu frame, but they pick up the SARS frame, which is not about mitigation, which is about elimination. So they took very, very radical actions to eliminate it. They were successful. And in fact, there are very recent data that show that not only New Zealand fared better with health issues, but their GDP were better than comparatively to the UK. And so they won on both fronts by framing it the right way. So framing properly can save life.
Having a rich repertoire of frames can make it easier for a person to find the best solution for a given situation. I was curious if you could talk about how, or what is your recommendation for trying to acquire a catalog of frames to work with, to apply to a situation?
So I think it's to get out of your comfort zone, is to when you want to listen to a podcast, I should not say that to, on your show, but we tend to listen to the same podcast, of course, that the one that we like, and certainly yours. But it's nice time to time to listen to the podcast we don't want to listen to. Like we think it's not interesting, or we may be shocked with what people are saying. And as we listen to these other podcasts, it's about making, not getting bored, not getting angry, but to try to uncover what are the causal assumptions that people are making about how the world works. What are the constraints they are putting on their thinking? What do they live outside, but what are their focus? And by doing that, we learn new ways of representing the world. And who knows, again, you know, it depends on the context. That frame may be helpful to you in a different situations. So that's how you expand, is to forcing yourself to go outside what you know best, outside what interests you, and to read what you would not read normally.
You touched briefly about machines and or programming, and why is framing impossible for a machine to emulate?
I love that question. Let me step back just a sec, if you allow me.
Please.
The machine, if you think about it, the machine is the outcome of a reframing. So the very machine we have was born from someone called Alan Turing, who reframed what mathematics is, basically. And the way he reframed it, he says, you know, when you write a mathematical proof, it's like typing on a typewriter. And that typewriter, it was just in his mind. He wrote a whole research paper about it, but it was just abstract. And that typewriter is the computers I'm using right now to do a Zoom session with you. So the machine was born out of ability to frame. Now, why does a machine can't frame? It's because the machine, the only thing that a machine does in the end is to get close to the data and then face a problem and try to use the data to find data points that are very close to what you observe. So it's very, very stuck to the data. And that's why machines need a lot of data. You saw the rise of machine learning because it came right after big data, basically. So without a lot of data, machine is useless. What we can do, though, we function totally differently. We use very few data points, and we extrapolate well beyond those data. We do things that the machine can't, because the machine is stuck to this data. So in a sense, that's why the machine cannot frame. And if you want me to be a bit more philosophical, if you imagine a machine that can frame, that is, can represent the world, develop its own representation of the world, at some point that machine is going to create a representation of itself. And here you start to talk about consciousness, self-awareness, and I really think we are far, far, far away from that.
My last two questions for you, being this is right on radio, I think it's only appropriate that I have to ask you these questions. There's a great line that I think I'll never forget in the book. You talk about metaphors and the value of in trying to relay information. Metaphors are an expression of frames. I was wondering if you could talk about the significance of that and why, in like an evolutionary sense, of how people develop metaphors for dispersing information.
Well, so the metaphors and frames are linked in many ways. So it's there's communications, but our ability to represent, our ability to develop those mental models, to think in mental models, was likely due to language. And because when we started to learn language or to develop language in the history of evolution, we started to use language to create metaphor. And this ability to create metaphor start to be a proto-mental model. And so there is a lot of research that show that probably our ability to represent the world is born from this language and this ability to speak in metaphors. But of course, you can use metaphor to try to, and this is advertisements is doing that all the time, is to try to elicit a mindset that is a specific way of representing the world in someone else's head. So that would be a way to change the mental representations to someone else.
And so one of the primary means, of course, where we see a lot of metaphors play out is in the form of storytelling. But I want to talk about the value of that and how we use that based we use it to maybe different assessments of how we play out different scenarios. I was going to talk about maybe how storytelling works.
I mean, so storytelling has many components to it. What we know is that the idea of talking, of telling stories and imagining through stories plays out is also a way for us individuals to become better framers, because we practice counterfactual. We imagine an alternative realities. If I tell you John wanted to be king, he took some arsenic. I just told you two sentences, and look at what happened in your head. You're in the Middle Age. Probably you picture yourself some unhappy prince, and then you have a causal assumption for why he's taking the arsenic, because he wanted to be king. But all that is you creating this reality, this counterfactual, based on the two sentences as I gave you. So the storytelling, telling stories, is also a way to practice that, to become better at it, and to train that cognitive muscle.
We are unfortunately out of time, but this has been a delight. I've enjoyed every single part of this conversation with you, and it was a wonderful read. I would encourage anyone to check out Framers, Human Advantage in an Age of Technology and Turmoil. Thank you so much for being
here
on Radio with us.
It was a real pleasure. Thanks.